Good evening, everyone. Welcome tonight to Salt Lake Community College and to the first of what we hope will be an ongoing series of events that I think will help, we hope, bring our community together. My name is Bill Krim. I'm the president and CEO of United Way of Salt Lake. And some of you might not know anything about United Way. Some of you might know United Way from a long time ago. And I just want to mention, if you do know United Way from the past, it's important for me to tell you that we're not that United Way. Not that there was anything wrong with that. That United Way raised money, distributed it to charities in our community, and good things happened. But what we noticed many years ago was that does not solve the complex social problems we face as a community. So for the past several years, our goal, our approach, our work has been to build partnerships and to try to identify specific social problems and within those partnerships bring people together to measurably improve outcomes for low-income kids, for families, for populations that are marginalized. And there's no shortage of social problems. I think if you're here today, it's probably because you think about that a lot. And our goal tonight, specifically, is to take a deeper dive into understanding, thinking about, and exploring the divisiveness that exists seemingly more than ever in our community, to explore the issues of race and class and hate that get in the way of us coming together as a community to make sure that everyone has the opportunity to live with dignity and respect. And our goal with all of these events will be to pursue that kind of understanding, knowing that what happens here in this room or in any of the other venues needs to be carried out through our actions or continued actions. And we hope that this event helps give us thoughts and ideas and inspires us to do more of that. This is the first of a three-part series, and we hope you'll join us for the second one, August 29th, here in this same place. Where Nicole Hannah-Jones, New York Times award-winning investigative reporter and modern-day civil rights writer, will be our guest. Again on November 1st at the Rose Wagner Theater with Claudio Sanchez, who's a former elementary and middle school teacher, but also the education correspondent for NPR, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Weekend Edition. If you're interested, if that sparks your interest, you can go online after June 20th and reserve your tickets at speakerseries.uw.org. And we're going to get started. Before we do that, I want to thank our sponsors, though. We could not do this without our presenting sponsors, Dominion Energy and Bank of America Merrill Lynch, without our major sponsor, which is Comcast, and our supporting sponsors, Parsons, Bailey & Latimer, and Aspira Public Affairs. Finally, I'd like to have us all thank KUER for being an amazing partner in this effort. It's been a pleasure to work with them. We're so excited to be doing this. They perform such an amazing service and role in our community, and we're lucky to be partners with them and their ability to bring people like Kelly McEvers, who I just met today, and I had to confess to her that I hadn't been a podcast person before we started to plan this event, and I felt like, well, I better listen, and now I'm a convert, and I'm worried I'm not going to be able to show up for work. My boss might be a little stressed about that, but if you haven't listened to her podcast, Embedded, please do that. To introduce Kelly, I want to invite Maria O'Mara, the general manager of KUER, to come and do that introduction. Thank you.
Welcome, everyone. It is such a pleasure to be here. It's really been great to catch up with Bill. There was a time several decades ago when I was a very young reporter, and he was helping me understand this community in his role working for Utah Issues, and I'm so glad to be able to work with him again as we continue to seek to understand one another better. It is a real privilege to introduce Kelly McEvers to you this evening. As co-host of All Things Considered, we probably feel we already know her. So we have an advantage. She is such a wonderful guide through what is an ever-changing world of politics and war and technology and business and entertainment. And guides like Kelly are more important than ever. Of course, as Bill mentioned, Kelly is the host of Embedded, which has given me personally the most up-close experience on such a variety of issues, literally changing the way I think about police shootings or the opioid epidemic in America, because I have seen those issues through her eyes, and she has explained them with the level of detail, with genuine curiosity, and with compassion. And so the picture she's painted for me and the people that she has brought into my understanding has absolutely changed the way I look at the world, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity to continue to listen to Embedded. Before her current position, Kelly was a national correspondent at NPR West. She ran NPR's Beirut Bureau. While there, she won a variety of awards, including a Peabody, DuPont Columbia, Gracie, and Overseas Press Club Award. She made a radio documentary about being a war correspondent with producer Jay Allison. And before coming to NPR, she covered the former Soviet Union and Southeast Asia. She started her career as a print journalist at the Chicago Tribune. Ladies and gentlemen, Kelly McEvers.
You know, in your family, when you have siblings and you're not supposed to have, or children and you're not supposed to have a favorite, you know, you're supposed to be like, I love you all equally. All my brothers and sisters at all the stations around the United States. So that's what I'm supposed to say. But KUER is one of my favorite stations, and it's just a real honor to be here. Every time they ask me to come, I'm like, yes, yes, I'm coming back. So it's really, really great to be here, and thanks for that. Thanks for having me. And thanks to everyone from the United Way also. I spent a bunch of years, as you just heard, in the Middle East. In addition to being in Beirut, I was in Baghdad, I was in Yemen, I covered Bahrain, I covered a lot of the Arab Spring uprisings. Spent a bunch of years doing that. And eventually, my time was up, I had to come back home. They dragged me kicking and screaming back to the United States. And I did a story about my hometown, which is sometimes kind of a cliche thing to do, to go back to your hometown and be like, what's wrong with my hometown? But I went back and I did a story about what's wrong with my hometown. I grew up in a town in central Illinois called Lincoln, and it had changed quite a bit. The middle class had sort of disappeared, and opioids were making their way into the town, and policing was an issue, and the school was losing resources. And I thought, what's going on here might help me understand what's going on in America. So I did a story, and I remember the final quote of the story was this guy, a Chicago-based think tank guy, and he said, you've covered revolutions before. Think about this as a revolution in this country. Things are changing. And it got me thinking about how to cover the news back here in the United States. And I also had a lot of friends who said, you know that thing you did in the Middle East, you know, when you go run around and go to difficult places and talk to people? We should do that here. So the idea for this podcast called Embedded was born. It was kind of a play on this idea of being embedded in the military as a journalist, because I covered Iraq, although I didn't do very many embeds. But the idea was just to kind of go get down on the ground in places where things are happening and stay there until you understand it. The tagline of the show is we take a story from the news and go deep. So as you heard Maria say, we've done stuff about the opioid crisis, HIV outbreak in the United States in 2015. We've done stuff, you know, we did stuff about the Texas biker gang war. We did a story in El Salvador that we talked about. We've looked really deeply at police shootings. That's a thing. We're spending our next round of stories, we're looking very deeply at the Trump administration and some of the people in the administration and kind of trying to look back at the public record of this president, his record as a businessman, his record as a TV star, frankly. What can we learn from that record? We're spending a bunch of time in coal country to sort of see how that's going to go, given that that's now a priority of this administration. But one of the stories we did, and it's the story I'm going to share with you tonight, was called The School. And it came out of, we talked, you know, when I talked to folks about what we wanted to talk about tonight, we thought talking about education could be a really important way to start off this series. And so we've been noticing and obviously been reading the headlines that schools are closing in places like Chicago, Washington, D.C., even here. And rather than come down with some really important verdict on whether or not that was right or wrong, because I think in every community it's really complicated, we just wanted to know what it felt like. We're in this era, right, of school choice, right, where people have more choice than they ever have before to choose to go to a different school, and that means some schools are being left behind and they don't have the resources that they need to stay open. So we chose a school, and if we could put up the first picture here, that'd be great. Yeah, there it is, in Wilkinsburg, Pennsylvania. It's a 100-year-old school. Actually, yeah, let's show the second image. You can see an old postcard of it from back in the day. The man who founded the Scholastic Publishing Company actually went to the school. It was in a very middle-class suburb of Pittsburgh, a part of the world that has undergone all kinds of changes over the decades. Lots of people leaving the community, and the school has had a really hard time. It's become one of the worst performing schools in Pennsylvania. And once that became true, students and their parents made choices to leave. Some went to charter schools, some went to private schools, some went to figure out how to go to other traditional public schools. So, you know, it's not this clear-cut picture of everyone went and left for this one place. But what we know happens, well, and you're gonna hear it, I'm gonna play tape, and you're gonna hear a story of what it's like when your school closes. It was a school that was built for 1,000 people, and by the time we showed up, there were only 200 people there, and that was middle and high school students. It was supposed to be a high school for 1,000 people. The school had, by this point, made a deal with a neighboring community inside the Pittsburgh School District to send those remaining 200 kids to this other school, and that they would give them whatever money they basically had left in the coffers. And so Embedded sent reporter Shireen Marisol Meraji. She's a great reporter on NPR. She worked with us on this episode. She also works for our Code Switch team. You're gonna hear her voice a lot. And a producer named Chris Benderev to the school. And I'm gonna start playing the tape and I'll narrate it through. It's a few minutes, so bear with me so you can just sort of feel what it's like when a school closes. It starts with Shireen, one of the first days in the school, talking to the kids about what they think, why they think the school is being closed. How did they find out? What did they know? And here it goes. It starts with Shireen.
Okay, what is your first and last name?
My name's Tiana Ramsey, and I'm 15.
Take me back to when you first found out that Wilkinsburg High School was closing.
I saw on a website the school was closing down, and I'm like, I don't believe that. I don't really believe they're going to close the school down. Where are the kids going to go now, and why are y'all closing the school? But no one could give me an answer for the second question, why are y'all closing it?
Have you pieced together an answer for yourself? Do you think you have an answer?
I think it's because we're African-American, we're black, that they're shutting the school down.
I think it's because we're black that they're shutting the school down. And Tiana wasn't the only kid who said this. A handful of kids said this to Shireen, you know, that this is happening to us because, you know, we're not being paid attention to. The school board, of course, said this is not true. It's way more complicated than that. The school was underperforming. A lot of kids, both white kids and black kids, left the school for a bunch of different reasons. And so Shireen asked another student what he thought about going to this new school that they'd made an arrangement with. The new school was called Westinghouse, and it is in a neighborhood called Homewood.
At first, I thought it was good until I found out who we was merging with.
18-year-old Marlon Rainey's been going to Wilkinsburg since seventh grade. He's graduating this year. Back in the 90s, Homewood and Wilkinsburg were in a gang war. And there's still this sense that the two neighborhoods do not get along and never will.
You know, they always been feuding for a while, so I don't know how it's gonna work when we make that merge with each other.
I mean, you're done, right? It's not high stakes for you.
Well, I do have a little brother that go here who's a ninth grader, and I really don't want him going to Western Coast. I don't know how to put it. Like, Wilkinsburg's not helping my little brother, neither is Westinghouse. Like, my little brother, he just get distracted by, like, the environment that he's in.
14-year-old Journey Ledbetter says the same thing.
We was forced to be in this environment. Your environment has a big part of how you act.
Journey doesn't want to go to Westinghouse either. He wants to go to a better school in a safer part of town. But he says they have no choice about where they're going to go. And the choice that's been made for them is in this other neighborhood that's just as messed up as theirs.
People dying every day. You know, everybody losing someone every single day. It really affects kids, and not just kids, everybody, the whole community. We need to stop the gun violence. It's really, man, I don't even know what to say. Gun violence, I lost a lot of friends from gun violence.
So basically what the kids are saying is, like, we didn't have a choice in this. We're being forced to go to this other school that our neighborhood has been in a feud with for a really long time. It could actually be dangerous for us to go to this other school. And that other school isn't necessarily doing much better than the school that's about to close anyway. So you really don't feel like they have a lot of agency. And Journey's also not exaggerating about the violence in the community. While Shireen and Chris, our producer, who you'll hear in a minute, while they were in Wilkinsburg reporting the story, I think it was on their third or fourth day there, there was a shooting in the community. It wasn't at the school. It was at somebody's party at a backyard barbecue. Four women and one man were killed by two shooters who, once Shireen and Chris heard about it, were still on the run. And so they get up and they think, well, let's go see what happened.
This is not the story we thought we would be doing in Wilkinsburg, but we still wanted to go. We wanted to be in the school and see how they handle something like this, even if the school is about to close.
So there are kids waiting for the school to open outside. I mean, it actually just seems fairly normal.
It's surprising how quiet the drive to school is. Hardly any traffic. No police tape, no checkpoint, even though the shooters are still at large. We make it just in time for the 7:30 staff meeting.
Everyone here, I'm missing Miss Sullivan. I need to get started because I don't know how long they're going to be. Several things on the agenda. Please don't take this.
Okay.
Principal Sean Johnston asked us to stop recording, but allows us to stay. She briefs the staff on how to handle the shooting news, says it might be really hard on the middle schoolers. It's been a year since the death of their classmate, 12-year-old Sincere Powell. He died of an overdose, and that anniversary was horrible at school. Kids crying, acting out in class. Today, she says, use your best judgment. If they aren't in the mood to learn, don't teach. Turn off the lights, turn on some music, help them relax.
So Shireen and Chris start walking around the school, trying to understand like how everyone's going to deal with it. And they're in the hallway at one point, and one other kid comes running in, and they realize that one of the women who was killed, was the mother of one of their classmates, one of the seniors' classmates, and she was a really beloved football mom too, in the school. So the kids get this news like in the middle of school. A bunch of them just sit down in the middle of the floor in the hallway. Really devastated. At one point, a janitor comes up and escorts them to an office, and where he sits with them for, 2 hours and just lets them kind of do their thing. And then Shireen and Chris go into a classroom to sort of hear how that goes. And it starts with a teacher by the name of Miss Boyer. And this is going to be some long tape because the story kind of develops from there. So just listen.
I didn't think that it was appropriate to keep today business as usual.
Carrie Boyer teaches high school English. She opens each period today with some version of this short speech.
So today, I am giving you the opportunity to have just a free write.
Turns out, Ms. Boyer has two of one of the victim's kids in her classes, Tanea and her little brother, Brashad, who's in this period. And they're not here today for obvious reasons. But the kids who did come to class, they seem like they're doing all right. There's not a lot of crying, actually.
They've become numb almost because it is such a common occurrence. A few years ago, another colleague of mine who started at the same time as I did, and he's no longer here, but we sat and we counted how many students from the time we started until the time at that, I think it was like 3 or 4 years ago, and we were up to like 25.
And 25 dead students. And she says it's more like 30 now. All but two died violent deaths. So yeah, this is the kind of thing that starts to feel weirdly normal for a lot of these kids. But during her free periods between classes, they come in to process the news in maybe not so obvious ways. They walk in, ask if she has a snack or something to drink.
You got any more water?
I do not have water. But I have a Dr. Pepper and I have peach tea.
Ms. Boyer has a mini fridge near her desk with drinks and fruit in case they're thirsty or hungry and don't have anything at home, which she says happens a lot. 18-year-old Anthony Fleming wants water. 16-year-old Jaquela Gilmore just asked for some gum. But they eventually start talking about the shooting.
Then that's when my mom started ratting around Wilkinsburg, going to other people's houses, like, is my son here? Is my son here? Like, and I was like, oh my God, I just never want our family to ever experience that.
But you know, I bet you though that that fear and that panic will make you do some things you wouldn't do on a normal day though. You know what I mean? I mean, your mom doesn't always go riding around looking for your brother.
She said in her face that she was scared. Like, she said, I'm not going to sleep till I find out where my son's at.
My dad, first, he's the first one who called me. Then my mom called me. And then my best friend called me because I didn't know what happened.
The news keeps saying they had an automatic AK, and I'm just thinking, like, it couldn't have been an AK because you kept hearing the shots go off, like, so you know he kept pulling the trigger.
The fact that you even know that just blew my mind, Clay, but okay.
Because it sounds like first person let their clip go, and then a second person let their clip go.
Obviously, I know about, like, Rashad and Tanea's mom and stuff, but were any of the other victims related to anybody?
They didn't drop the rest of the victims' names. They just gave the ones that died out.
Brittany Powell and somebody else.
It was her sister, Shade Powell, I think, or Shade Powell.
Yeah, Shade.
And then it was Tina.
Tina and Jerry. But they said 8 people got shot. Because first on the news, they said, okay, 4 people got shot. The next thing you know, 5 people come up dead. I'm like, yo, they just changed from 4 people to shot that 5 people dead to 8 people shot. Like, and then they brought the little baby out. Like there was kids in the house. And then one of the girls was pregnant. Basically, it was 6 people that died, if you want to be technical.
Yeah, I don't know which one it was, but she was pregnant. And she got shot, too. I said, oh, my God, this is crazy. I gotta get out the hood, cause this is too much.
I hope you all get out of the hood.
My senior year, I'm trying to go to Florida, cause you could graduate with a trade.
Looking back on this day, it's so clear that this school means a lot more than classes and homework and test scores.
When something like this happens, Wilkinsburg High School is a safe place in what can be a violent neighborhood. There's structure inside this building. When outside, there's a lot of chaos.
And the kids feel safe in other ways, too. Safe to share their sadness and their frustrations with people they've known for years. The librarian, their security guards, their English teacher, Ms. Boyer.
And I don't think we'll ever be able to recreate anywhere else what was here.
But they're gonna have to recreate it somewhere else. They don't have a choice. Most of these kids are going to end up at Westinghouse.
So what about Westinghouse, the place everyone seems so not at all excited about? We check it out for ourselves the next day.
It's about a 10-minute drive from Wilkinsburg High, and it's close in other ways, too. The neighborhoods surrounding the schools look alike, abandoned homes, overgrown yards. And when you walk in...
There's 2 sets of metal detectors here. Metal detectors. And where there are metal detectors, you're most likely to find poor students of color. Westinghouse is a majority black school, just like Wilkinsburg. And the test scores are on par with Wilkinsburg's. Low. But from the moment you walk in, this school, the one that everybody's been talking smack about, it seems great. 8th graders Jalen McClary and Camille Andrews give us a tour.
You're on student council?
Yes. I am the president, and Jalen... She's the vice president.
Okay, so where are we going now?
So we get on the elevator.
Camille and Jalen take us by the school store.
It's open during lunch and after school. We have hot Cheetos, Kool-Aid jammers, Skittles.
Yes, you can snack on hot Cheetos and rock your Bulldog swag when you root for the home team during a swim meet at the school's indoor pool. No pool at Wilkinsburg. More into cooking than swimming?
This is the culinary arts room. We have cooking class here. Can we go and see?
Mr. Vishner, the culinary arts teacher, invites us in. Inside, a high schooler named Otis walks by with a huge metal bowl full of freshly cooked French fries.
Thank you. Yeah, so it's a 3-year program where students get everything they need to know how to be an entry-level cook or chef when they go into the business.
Perfectly salted and very crispy.
Thank you.
Way to go, Otis.
Really good.
Yeah, fine. Thank you, Mr. Vishner.
Of course.
And down the hall, there's more vocational training.
When you get in high school, you can apply for like what you want to do, like nursing, cosmetology, construction.
Oh, that's carpentry.
Let's go in.
And we finish our tour at the library, where there are lots of brand new Apple computers.
Oh, there's lots of computers.
And one teenage boy who really, really has to make a poop joke. Yes, some things are the same at every school.
She making us dissect poop. Who does that?
We have an owl pellet lab that we're doing, and it's regurgitation. It's not poop.
After the tour of Westinghouse, to be honest, we're conflicted.
Okay, any questions?
Any questions?
Question number one.
We have so many questions. We looked at the limited research that's out there about school closures, and it suggests for them to work, you've got to send the kids to a much better school. We'll call them A or B schools.
The Pennsylvania Department of Education grades schools out of 100. And last year, Wilkinsburg High School got a 40. Westinghouse, a 38. Both of those are F-minus schools. So that doesn't seem better for the kids, right?
But Westinghouse does have more up-to-date facilities, more honors classes, vocational training, a daycare, and a new principal. She goes by Ms. Z. We met her, and her Westinghouse pride is contagious. She has a 5-year plan to make the school better academically.
What about those intangibles, though? The role that the Wilkinsburg staff plays as a surrogate family for the kids. That safe place right there in their own neighborhood. What happens when that's gone?
We don't know the answers to any of these questions, and we probably won't have them for a long time. What we do know is the year is almost over. The school is about to shut its doors forever. So we head back to Wilkinsburg for the last day of school.
And graduation.
It's so interesting, right, to hear these kids talking so vividly and so, like, with such familiarity about a shooting, but then to hear the way the school kind of just wraps its arms around the kids when something like this happens, it makes you understand how important the school is in the community. And then you start to think, oh, you can't close the school. And then you go to the new school and you're like, but wait a second, the new school sounds way better. So what should we do? Like Shireen and Chris said, they have a lot of questions. They don't have a ton of answers, but it's just so nice to get in there and tell the story. I'm going to finish up. Just I want you to hear just a little tiny bit of the graduation. By the time the senior class of Wilkinsburg High School, Middle School graduated, there were 25 graduates. Let's do picture number 3 if we could. I think it's of the graduates, yeah. 25 graduates, that was it. They had a really nice, really emotional, ceremony. Miss Boyer, the students gave Miss Boyer an award for all the help that she had given them and all the snacks and drinks. They actually chose one of their teachers from the past to be the speaker at the graduation. And there's kind of this amazing thing that happens at the graduation, and then we'll finish up. He actually apologizes to the kids. And here's what he says.
We adults messed up. We wouldn't be where we're at now in this district if we didn't mess up.
This isn't your fault. It's the adults who put bad policies in place, wasted district money, didn't put you first. No matter what, you are stars. And although your world will be full of darkness, he says, the darker the night, the brighter the stars shine.
I can't lie to you. Night exists. Darkness exists, and it will continue to exist, right? But I've met the stars, and I'm just telling you, there is no reason for us to be fearful of the night with stars like this. Peace to you all. Good luck. You know where to reach me, and shine on, folks.
Let's look at picture number 4.
This concludes the grand finale of the Wilkinsburg Senior High School's graduating class of 2016.
Then we hear Pomp and Circumstance, of course. You know, some of these kids are doing really well. Some are, Anthony's at community college, and some of the kids who didn't graduate are at Westinghouse, the new school. Some kids have chosen to go to charter schools in the area. Other kids have moved away because they just so didn't want to go to Westinghouse. It's been interesting to follow up in that with some of these kids. I mean, I wish I could tie all this up with a bow and say school choice and school closings are either good or bad, but I can't. I mean, this question of school choice right now is a really difficult one, especially since the election. I know a lot of people have very strong feelings about the new Secretary of Education, who has come down, you know, pretty hard on one side of this issue. For me, telling stories doesn't necessarily resolve a conflict, but it's a way to start talking about a conflict like this, something that can be so divisive and so difficult in a community. You know, people always ask me, like, why should I tell you my story? It's like, because the person who's sitting, who might be just like sitting across from you on the bus or down the street from you, hasn't put themselves in your shoes. And if we can sort of do our jobs, which is like go out and listen to you and sort of force people to kind of stand in your shoes, it might start the kinds of conversations that we need to have. There's this great quote that I love. I think it's by Joan Didion. It's, we tell ourselves stories in order to live. It's how we understand the world. And so with that, I think we want to hear not just this story, but from stories from some of the folks from the community here. So would you guys come up, and then we can get started with our conversation. But thanks very much. And the chair and the couch. Come on up. Thanks. Cool. And sorry, you guys all have to squeeze on the couch. Okay, I want you all to welcome Halima Hussein, who was born in Somalia, spent many years in Kenya as a refugee. She currently serves as the Refugee Women's Coordinator for the Utah Refugee Services Office. She's also worked with Planned Parenthood of Utah. She is passionate about women's empowerment and children's well-being. Welcome. And also Jennifer Mayer Glenn. She is currently the Director of Family School Collaboration at the Salt Lake City School District, working to build the capacity of schools to create welcoming and family-friendly schools that utilize the talents and skills of their families. She also does advocacy work with the Utah Coalition of La Raza, the oldest Latino civil rights advocacy organization in Utah. Welcome to you. And we have Jose Enriquez, who is originally from El Salvador. He says he is living his dream as the full-time executive director of Latinos in Action. It's a nonprofit that he built from the ground up, starting in 2001. It's currently implemented in 124 schools across Utah, Idaho, Washington, Texas, and Florida. The mission is to empower Latino youth to be college and career ready through culture, service, and leadership. Welcome to you. Thank you. And Eddie Barest, who is vice president of Granite Education Association. He attended the NEA conference to speak up for minorities, teachers, and students' rights. He has been an educator going on 18 years. He says he did not have any minority male teachers growing up, and he wanted to be a role model in order to make a difference. Welcome to you. So lucky to have all you. And I don't think the idea is to spend the entire evening talking about school choice and school closings, but when I mentioned it to a couple of you, you did have some interesting things to say, and so I thought, Eddie, we would start with you. You're an educator. I know that they're, not far away in the Granite School District, there was a high school that closed at one time. You know, that's something that you're very familiar with. Maybe you want to talk about that and sort of your reaction to what you just heard.
The reaction to me is something I've grown up my whole life with, so it's not very shocking to me. We closed Granite High School due to it was an older facility, and it wasn't very safe for the children, so they closed it. But some of the discrepancies I have in our district is money is not given out equally. And we can get into that about it.
I can take all the time. Elaborate.
Do tell.
We're here to talk about, we're here to
dig in. All right, let me get comfortable.
Exactly, let's do this. Come on.
Okay, let me give you a little brief scenario about me. I'm from Utah. I'm half black and half white. My mother was disowned because of my father. And so growing up, I got to see the good and bad on both sides. And growing up and trials and tribulations, eating out of garbage cans, trying to find out how you make it in this life. And I had some great teachers. They're wonderful if they cared about you. And it's very hard to find teachers that are open-minded enough to love a child, even if they're from a different religion background or society. And for me, the teachers who loved me and opened up, I did my best for them. But the ones who didn't or disrespected me, yeah, I'm sure you guys can already tell. That was a long day for them. And so it comes down to, basically, in my opinion, after 18 years, I want to get into education because I see what was going on. And from being on a student side, now as an educator, and the discrepancies are going on, things aren't fair. They say that we want everyone to be equal, and a lot of people are upset when lower income schools need help, and they feel like it's just giving to welfare, giving, 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 and they can't think of it like that. They got to think of it in the sense of, we need to give people tools to help themselves. It's called privilege. And yesterday at the University of Utah, I gave a privilege speak on, and I had participants stand up in a straight line, and I had a series of 50 questions, and you either scooted forward or you scooted back. And that was a great tool to open up people's eyes, to let them really see.
What were some of the questions?
Okay, one of them was, take a step forward if you ever went on a family vacation out of the country before the age 18. Or if you had a pool cleaner, gardeners, maids, things like that. One of the negative questions was, if your parent did not graduate from high school, take a step back. And it was really intriguing to open up the minds. And the way I started off was, I challenged anybody. I had some volunteers, and I wanted to show them my privilege. And if you would like to, get a volunteer out of the stage, and we can have that right now.
Any takers?
Any Maybe takers? Afterwards. Anybody in shape want to come up here? You got to challenge me, though. You got to be in shape.
It's like a duel, a privilege duel.
Yeah.
Well, good. Well, right, see, we'll save it for the end.
It was just a sense to where I have a certain privilege that comes easy to me, and other people could train and work out, and they're not going to be able to beat me at this. And if you flip that script, that's what a lot of students of color and socioeconomic are going through. We're giving them tools, but they don't understand how to use the tools completely. Mm-hmm. It's kind of foreign to them. And a lot of teachers don't understand how to work with the kids nowadays. Mm-hmm. Teachers want students to come up to their level. And from a person who comes from a one-sided background, as far as poverty, that's the worst thing you can do. You have to go to their level. Like, for example, when I started teaching, I would eat in the cafeteria every day with the kids. Because if you get to know them, show the passion, show the concerns, and get to know them as a different child, not just a face or a name, they'll do anything for you. And I've been trying to give that message for 18 years, and a lot of teachers are like, oh, that's my time. Well, if you put a little effort into it, it's gonna make things better in the long run for your classroom management. Mm-hmm. So that's a bit about me. I don't wanna take up all the time.
No, I like it.
Let's get going.
You know, I wanna hear, I think again, you know, I believe so deeply in people telling their stories, and Jose, I think you do too, and I know you've got a really interesting story, but you said something really interesting to me before we got up here, and you said, you think that we right now in the education system suffer from something you call narration sickness.
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that? What does that mean?
Yeah, you know, our kids are so beautiful, and they come with this schema. So everybody say schema.
Schema.
Right? Schema is this background knowledge. It's beautiful. It has all this experience, life experience, all these things that they come with, assets. Mm-hmm. But sometimes in the rhetoric of the community or what's happening, these assets, the schema is almost stifled. Unless, as adults, I really believe this nation suffers from narration sickness. We don't narrate
really
our
in
stories.
In an era of social media when we're like, I just had a hamburger.
Yeah.
but that's not enough of a story,
no,
is what,
like,
you're saying. Yeah.
Certain characters in a tweet, right? But our kids, what what they would love is they would love to know who you are. Like you said, he sat by them. And then just telling your story, I got to speak to some people in our reception, and I love to meet, because as soon as they narrate their story, where they're from, Oklahoma, Texas, wherever, I went to this law school, so forth, and then they start kind of going deeper into their story, that allows me to then say, oh, I have something in common, or I want to tell you my story. Our youth, they so want to tell their stories, and they want to give more, but sometimes we don't narrate our stories to them. We could be across the hallway, even teachers, and they're texting to one another when they could go touch. The technology today has also limited us and also blocked us from what we used to do, and just go talk to your neighbor, right? And go talk to your teacher right next door. Go walk over there, tell stories. Those stories are beautiful because it allows others to also narrate theirs. And our youth, if you could hear their stories, if I would go to any high school out here and hear the stories in our hallways and collect them all, we would have a bestseller today.
Easily, I mean, I agree wholeheartedly, right?
But we have to narrate. As adults, we can't be scared or fearful of certain people or things. If you would just say hi to a student that you don't know and you just say, here's who I am, here's what I'm about, they would do the same. So we need to narrate our stories to our youth. A lot of times, I would say we misuse our youth. They're incredible, they're resilient, but sometimes we think they're monsters, right? Teenagers. But they're amazing, and if we were to use them more, they could change the fabric of what's going on. They have so many innovative ideas. If we just set the stage wherein they can showcase their talents, you could just step back and just watch it. And that's what I love. I'm not fearful of our future because I see these kids day in and day out with my program, and I'm hopeful of our future. Mm-hmm. They're incredible.
All right. So Jennifer, I want to hear a little bit about your story. Your organization is kind of built on this idea that schools are not necessarily designed for kids of color. And so getting families of color and getting kids of color into schools and getting them in there is really helping to change that. Tell us that. Tell us how that works.
Well, the families, typically when we look at our schools that are high performing, we have a lot of family engagement. And there's this unwritten expectation that I don't think those of us in the education system even recognize, and that is there's an expectation that kids come to school knowing the alphabet, that they have this vocabulary level of 30,000 words, right? That they come with this set of skills, and our system was designed around that. And we have a lot of students who don't necessarily come with those skills, and so they begin at a deficit. And the problem is that we always blame them, and we blame their families for that, where really it's our system's fault, right? Mm. Really what we need to do is change our system so that any child that enters our system is getting the support that they need. And in Utah, especially, we like to claim that we don't depend on federal funds and so on and so forth. But really, the only way that we're trying to mediate any of this is that we're using federal funds. We use Title III for our English learners. We use Title I for our kids in poverty. And we don't fund education. And our state has to figure that out. Like, we've got to get that right. We have got to be able to support our families and our kids no matter who they are. We made commitments to many, many years ago, the Treaty of Guadalupe. We said we would educate everyone. And we're not doing a very good job of that. So that's something that we need to work toward. And in terms of working with families and really helping them understand how the system works so that they can be advocates, because we do have parents who are advocates and kids are getting what they need, but those aren't typically the parents of color. Mm-hmm. There are white parents who understand the system and who can walk in there and say, I demand this. Like, my kid needs this. My child has a disability and I expect these services for my kid. And everybody else sort of holds back, and they have great respect for the school system, but it's at the detriment of the education of their kids. They need to be in there advocating, and so that's what I get to do, is to teach them how to advocate and to teach them to become parent leaders and to get into the system so that we can transform it so that it works for all of our kids and not just some of our kids.
Nice. And Halima, you work with children and women. You're an advocate for refugees. Tell us just a little bit about that work that you do, some of the successes and some of the challenges.
So I work as the women's coordinator. And most of the refugee women are single parents, and they are just single mothers. Because of the war, most of the men have been killed or they are still fighting wherever they are. And so they come with big families, and it's really difficult for them. So what DWS does is they try and make programs tailor-made for only the women, and that includes the youth. First, to start with, the youth are more powerful than the parents. The positions just change when they come here. Mm-hmm. Because where we come from, they depended on us for everything. And when they come here, they learn English faster than their mothers, and they also learn how to drive, and they can get jobs, and so they're in control. They pay the bills for the mother, so it becomes really difficult for them. And also maybe because of the culture, the two cultures, it's really hard. They're conflicting every time, and the children are becoming like very independent, not independent good sometimes and independent not good. So we have to really, what we do is we try and educate the women about how to go about taking control in of some of the things so that the kids can go to school. We have very good programs in Utah for kids, but the system itself, because if somebody comes like with kids who are maybe 15, 16 years old, they are going to be put in 9th grade, 10th grade, and maybe they've not even gone to school, and if they have, it's not that level. So sometimes they get frustrated and they don't want to go to school. So the programs we have are for kids to help them bridge that. The struggle, they still struggle, but we are really improving on how to help them. The school districts are really engaged with this, and I think eventually there's going to be a big change.
And I hate to even have to ask this question, but I have to ask this question in this time that we live in. Are you seeing more animosity toward children from other places? In the form of, you know, small things as maybe bullying or other types of incidents.
Yeah, so that's what the Refugee Services Office really works with the school districts. There's been bullying reported, and the women also, because some of them, especially who are Muslims, because of the hijab, they can be identified very easily, whatever they, and they have brought reports that they have been bullied or harassed in a bus or anything, something like that. So the Refugee Services Office is engaged with the safety, public safety office to follow up on these kind of cases. So I know it's happening in schools, but the school districts are working on that.
And taking it seriously.
Yes.
That's good to hear. Jennifer, I know you have been involved also in your work, I would assume with LADASA, doing Know Your Rights workshops in this, shall we call it, new era. Why don't you talk about that and what you've been doing and if you think it's working.
So actually, it was through the school district, which is kind of amazing that I was allowed to do it, but I know how to be kind of politically savvy, so I was able to kind of maneuver around and say, this is about our families creating emergency plans, and it is. That's one of the things that we're working toward, but it really came...
In the emergency being?
Immigration emergencies.
Yes.
The day after the election, I was contacted by teachers, parents, other staff members, other community members saying, what are we gonna do? Like, people are afraid, our families are afraid, and definitely our immigrant families, our refugee families, we have lots of refugee kids who have fallen out of status because of issues that they've gotten involved in with the juvenile justice system, and they lose status. So there are a lot of people in our community that are impacted around the immigration concerns. And I pulled together information from ACLU, from Comunidades Unidas, which is a local organization. We got the emergency family plan translated into 7 languages, and we systematically offered a Know Your Rights workshop at our schools, and we've done it in about 11 or 12 schools, and provided families a way for them to create an emergency plan so that we know what will happen with kids if parents are detained, which is happening. And we know what will happen with property that families have. We know where kids will be cared for, and it's been heartbreaking to be a part of that and to sit down with some of the moms who have no recourse. There's nothing they can do. The way to apply for immigration, for legal status in the United States, there's no hope for some people. Mm-hmm. And so what do? You either get your deportation order and you leave, or you go deeper into hiding. And that is the choice of a lot of our families. And it's been, I've talked to a lot of immigration attorneys who, we've had people who have applied for asylum from Central America, and you would think that they would get it, and they don't. And so then they receive their deportation orders. And we have, I can think of 2 moms right off who both had children with disabilities. And one mom applied for her child with Down syndrome, who was a citizen, so she could stay and take care of her child with Down syndrome. But because there was a 19-year-old brother who was an adult, mom was deported, 19-year-old brother was put in custody of his sister with Down syndrome. So this is like real, yeah. Right? This is happening right now. Right. And it's painful and heartbreaking, and whatever we can do to try to mitigate and support the trauma that kids are experiencing, the fear they have to go to school, the fear parents have to take kids to school is kind of overwhelming.
You know, it's interesting because when we started out talking, I think we were talking about problems and issues that exist within the school system and have existed for a long time, right? These schools aren't necessarily ready for families of color, and you know, they need more tools. You know, the kids need more tools, yeah, to sort of realize who they are, and they need to not be blamed for what they're talking about. How much worse is it now under the new administration, right? We were talking about a system that for decades had persisted. Jose, I mean, what's your sense right now? Is it beyond these incidents where children could face deportation because they're, yeah, not here legally, or discrimination because they're refugees? Are there other issues coming up now?
Yeah.
And is it actual policy? Because it doesn't feel like there's been a whole lot of policy change. Or is it more just sort of a feeling that's kind of coming, yeah, from the top?
You could cut it.
Yeah.
You could cut it. And I you know, sometimes people don't realize because they're just not feeling it. But let me just, a perfect example. I just came from Orlando, Florida, where we have the program there. And Granger High School has 7 classes of Latinos in Action, and they wrote me some thank you letters. So on the plane, I took advantage and I took this stack of thank yous. And as I was reading it, so most of the letters said, it felt like they were thanking me for giving them a program where they can speak and the voice, and they could have a voice. So really what they're saying to me is, thanks for giving me permission and helping me understand who I am and my identity and be proud of who I am, which to me is sad that kids need permission, right, in a sense, a stage, a program within our school system to give them pride of who they are, where they come from, and to have a voice to say, you know, I'm not scared. Actually, I want to do better. I can go to college. I can succeed. I can be proud of who I am. Thank you for helping me understand my culture, my identity, and be proud of it. Thank you for allowing me to mentor younger kids, because then that allows me to give back. I actually feel like I'm contributing to my community by mentoring these younger elementary students. That's part of our program. Because what we want to do is give them confidence, because what they hear everywhere else is different. And the rhetoric out there is almost saying to them, you better stay low and lay low, right? Where I want to say, no, are you kidding? You're brilliant. You have two languages. You're bicultural. It's a lot more marketable. And if this country can't realize that, wow, right? That's how we got to where we are, is the backs of immigrants, right, who brought so much to our country. It's so rich. And I want our kids to understand they do come with richness, right? I was an undocumented kid from El Salvador. My mom came first the hard way. Swam, trunk of a car, desert. And I'm so grateful during the time of Iran-Contra, killings everywhere in El Salvador. Of course, a mother's going to flee that and then to send for her kids later. I came when I was 5, didn't know, you know, I was 5. What? How am I going to go back? Like, I'm here. Mm-hmm. And I'm so grateful for the opportunity that I had to later, through Amnesty and so forth, to become, you know, a permanent resident at that time, because I have a PhD now, right? I have a PhD. I'm a doctor. And yeah. And I wasn't okay with just being a doctor, though. I wanted to help. And I have, as an administrator of 12 years in Utah County and out here, I've helped all kids, not just Latino kids. I've helped the Caucasian kid. And let me tell you, I love that. I love to give back. But if I wouldn't have been given that opportunity, I wouldn't have been able to help so many kids, right? Mm-hmm. And there are many Jose's in these situations that are hiding when they shouldn't be, right? Because they have so much potential.
Yeah. I saw you nodding your head, Eddie, when I was asking that last question, so I'll just put it to you. How have things changed? And is it policy, or is it just more a feeling that's in the air? And if it's changed at all, have you seen it change?
I don't believe it has changed. Hmm. Growing up in the same district, Granite School District, from first grade to high school, and then teaching 18 years in that district, a lot of things come from the Capitol. And with GEA, we do a lot of political action, and we get out there and we try to talk to them, to legislators, and we have invited them numerous times. And you guys could help us. You know, what comes out in the public about teachers and test scores, they're only giving you half of the story. If you know a teacher, reach out, ask them what's going on. Don't believe what you hear on the TV, because it's not always accurate. And the issues that we're having is the policymakers are making all these different policies, but they don't understand anything. That's just like me trying to tell you, okay, well, let me rephrase that. They don't know anything about the teaching world, dealing with all these different kids, all the different disorders, all the different struggles they come with. And to me and my philosophy, that's like me trying to tell you how to become a journalist and what you need to be doing when that's not my forte. And as educators, why cannot we get the legislators who are leading us making policies into our classrooms? And my question is, our voices are not being heard, but everybody here, you're here for a reason. And I'm very proud to be here, be a part of this. And we need your help, in a sense, to where you guys have the connections with it. We just want a chance. Give us a chance. We're not going to do it the same way maybe you have done it, but there's more than one way to skin a cat. And then it comes down the political with, they tell us what to do, but they're not listening to us. So they won't come into our schools, they don't understand, and there's too much emphasis on testing. I mean, they want to test. They're testing these kids who are not at the grade level, do not understand everything, maybe don't have a computer at home or internet, and everything is pushed down, test. Teachers cry, they come talk to us about, they don't have time for anything else. It's worried about the stress of the test because it's their performance, it's their pay, and everything that's at stake. And nobody sees the big picture. All they see is, oh, teachers have it easy. Woo-hoo! No, wow. We don't.
Wow.
If you are, anybody out there, I teach at Lincoln Elementary and Gorley Elementary. Come one day uninvited and see what we deal with every single day. And it's the love and passion that we all have to be accepted. And we can't do this by ourselves. We've been trying, but without your guys' open minds, then it's gonna be the same struggle that it has for the last 30 years, in my opinion. And the reason why I wanted to do that privileged little activity real fast is to open up the mind to say, okay, now I understand what he's talking about, and wow, that's pretty powerful, because it's different through everybody's eyes.
Yep.
So I just say it comes down from the legislators to the districts making their own policy and doing what's best for the kid, not worrying about test scores and challenging other districts, and that pits us against each other instead of working as a community to make everything better. Things are not gonna change. As far as we have an ever-changing culture, embrace it and don't be afraid of that. And the reason why I say that is, being half black and half white, I've heard everything from both sides of my family, and I've always been the one to where I'm trying to bridge the gaps. You know, people who are black, they don't get offended so much when I say things, and then sometimes Caucasians don't get offended because I have part of that in me, and I embrace that, but I challenge them to get out of their comfort zone. That's what it comes about to me. We need you guys to get out of your comfort zone. Shake a hand, meet a friend. Don't worry about how they look. Get to know that person, and it's easier said than done. Thank you.
Okay, we're gonna take questions really soon from the audience. You just gave us a really concrete set of things that can be done. Get into the classrooms, shake hands with somebody you don't know, look people in the eye, see what we're actually doing. Let's do a speed round with the other three of you. If you had a magic wand, what are the things that you would do to change the way things are in your field? You want to go first, Halima?
So as a refugee myself, All the refugee women, especially the families, are just looking for friends. Next time you see somebody passing by and you think they are a refugee or you know they are a refugee, stop them and say hello to them, because that's all they need. They just need some encouragement. They're hardworking. They have very good children. They just need people to support them. You are the hosts. Please help them, and so that they can get on their feet, and then they'll just be like you, because we all are immigrants.
Not to put you on the spot, but what's your dream project?
One of the other things that we did and I do have to say, policy has changed. There's been money that has flooded into ICE in this state, and it has had an impact. I mean, we have a higher percentage of people who are being detained than other states do, because we have more money that has come into ICE and this relatively smaller population of undocumented people. But aside from that, I really feel like, you know, one of the other things that we've done is follow a model called Living Room Conversations, which is an opportunity for anybody. You can look it up, livingroomconversations.org, and you create an opportunity for people of differing perspectives to come into your home. It guides you through exactly how you do that, and you can have a conversation. They lay out exactly the format. They give you all of the questions that you can use, but it's a way for people to actually start to broaden their understanding of each other, and I think that that's one of the things that we need to do, is to work harder to understand each other.
Nice. And Jose?
No, I think for us, one of the biggest things that we want to do for our youth is exposure to the arts, the sciences. As much as we can, we want to expose them to as many professions as possible. So we would love for you to come to our classrooms. Just go to any high school or junior high and ask for the Latinos in Action course. Say, I want to talk to these young people about my pathway, how I got to be an engineer, how I got to be a dental hygienist. And I want to actually extend my help, not just tell them how you got there, but extend my help in internships, in apprenticeships. Help me link them, because there's this gap, right? They graduate and they're not all getting jobs. Right? There's employers that say, where are they? I want to hire them. And there's the other side, we're like, where are the jobs, right? We want to be that bridge. Come to these courses. You could do that tomorrow. I mean, Monday, right? You can go to any high school and say, I'd love to come teach the Latinos in Action course about this, right? At being an entrepreneur, right? These kids are hungry for it. We want to expose them to as many professions as possible. And then that brings a different light. Again, you're narrating your story, which allows them then to do the same.
Nice. Thank you. Well, thank you so much to our panelists. Just a huge round of applause to you guys. Thank you for sharing your stories and your ideas. And we want to have some time for questions and thoughts from the audience. I think there's a microphone here. The lights are coming up. Two microphones. Step on up. Go for it.
A couple years ago, we had a film here that KUER sponsored with the Film Society called Paper Tigers. And it's about trauma-informed practices. And there's so much that we can do on the surface, but if a child is damaged to the point that they have lost part of their capacity to learn until they're healed, how is it that that is being addressed and trauma-informed practices are being implemented with these kids that have often gone through terrible, terrible traumas? So I'd like to know what is happening in relationship to that.
Jennifer, yeah.
I know most about Salt Lake School District, but I do know that teachers have been, first of all, we've seen Paper Tigers a few times, and the following film, I think it's called Resilience. And there have been training for our teachers for them to learn strategies with individual kids, but then also using, you know, mindfulness techniques just during a regular classroom day, things that can help create a better learning environment so that that kids feel safe, that they're able to take risks. And then in addition to that, having resources to be able to refer them for the kind of care that they may need to counselors and so on and so forth. We don't have enough, but definitely there are some good practices that are happening in classrooms now.
Let me preface my question by saying I have a 31 and 29-year-old son, and they refer to me as the old fart. So understand where that question's coming from. I grew up in the civil rights and anti-Vietnam era and wrote my senior thesis in college on the use of language ambiguity to create political conflict. Why does no one talk about civil disobedience, particularly with ICE? It seems to me that there would be a rallying point if people were educated about nonviolent civil disobedience, where you have a tyrant in Washington, and the only way you can respond, in my judgment, is a nonviolent protest that says what you're trying to implement as policy is illegal and unconstitutional. Until it changes, we're going to disrupt the program.
I mean, it's difficult, right? Thank you for your comments, but I mean, it's difficult, right, to encourage some of these children of undocumented families to go out in a public space, I would imagine. Yeah?
But they're doing it.
Yeah, right, but they're doing it anyway.
And
we saw the protests at the airports at the time of the proposed ban. I mean, you saw so many people coming out saying.
I've been invited to many recent meetings and organizing events. There have been a lot of recent groups, Salt Lake Indivisible, that's just one that comes to mind, but a lot of organizations that have popped up recently where some of the organizing training is happening and the civil disobedience, it's happening. I think it's still pretty low key, but it's going on.
Yeah, anybody else thoughts about that?
Personally, for me, in my opinion, and my experience, there's so many different issues that the kids are having, and I think that everyone's trying to help, but in my opinion, they're going about it wrong. They're like busy bees, and they're not getting to the core of it. And with my psychology degree and working with the kids, every different age group, basically it just comes down to showing that you care about them and you accept them. You show a child that, yes, ADHD, bipolar, depression, all that stuff is gonna happen, but if you get that kid to trust you and to feel like they're cared about, because a lot of kids don't have that love at home. You know, I talk to my students, When's the last time that your family told you they loved you? And some of them have to sit there and think. And they're just not getting that love. And if they don't get that love, they act out. And that's where we're having the issues in the classroom. It just comes down to attention, love, and acceptance.
So for example, for the refugee community, mental health is a very big issue. And I would say most of the refugees have some kind of mental health issues. But for the kids, it's always different. They are more resilient as compared to the parents because, like most of the women who've come and have some mental issues, they are always sick, and whichever doctor they are taken to, they are not. The doctor says there's nothing wrong with her, and they are always very, very sick. So it's severe depression. Mm. But the kids are very active and well. And although they go through that mental health screening, they do better than parents. Hmm. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Hello. You were mentioning that in refugee and immigrant families, there is often a role reversal where children integrate faster and pick up the language more quickly than their parents, whereas you were discussing how to encourage parents to advocate for their kids and engage them more in the school system. So what do you do in situations where a child does need their parents to advocate for them if they're young or if they're disabled or have some other issues, but their parents either don't speak the language in addition to not being familiar with the school system or are just reluctant to leave their own community? Like, I'm from DC and I know Ukrainian, and the community there is like so insular. Like, there are parents who have been here for 15 years and still don't speak the language, don't want to speak the language, and don't want to sort of engage with their kids' American life. I don't know if that's a thing that happens, but how do you deal with that?
First of all, every parent has a right to an interpreter. So if they don't speak the language, that doesn't mean that they can't communicate. And so that's something that we make sure they understand, is that they can access an interpreter, and every school district has interpreters that are available. And then in addition to that, again, it's the working to create an environment where, I would say some of the most effective has been bringing parents together so that they can support each other and learn about how the school system works, learn about ways that they can advocate, meet the principal, meet the counselor, whoever they need to. And then they have people both in the system and outside of the system that they can trust and that they can go to help them advocate. I walked through a scenario with a parent recently who she's learning English. She wanted her daughter to see that she could also learn. So she's actually getting her high school diploma through Mexico in the United States because she and her daughter's in high school. She wanted her to see that they could do it. It's getting them to the point where they feel safe enough to ask and to be there and to be present. And it takes a community to do that.
No, I agree as well. I think sometimes there's a misconception that just because you don't see their parents at PTA or in the schools, that these parents don't care about their kids' education. And I'm gonna just say, my mom went through the most humiliating pathway to get here, just about died doing it. And if somebody's gonna tell me she didn't care about my education, then I'm gonna say, what more do you want? I mean, she cares, I promise. But when they're working 3 to 4 jobs to make ends meet, it's really tough to make these situations and to make PTAs and parent-teacher conference and so forth. So the best thing really is to scaffold, meaning, like Jennifer said, is to hold some first, just get to know you meetings, and then help them understand the system a little bit better and scaffold. That was what was helpful for my mom. And then allowing them to take some leadership roles within that group and then say, okay, now it's the gradual release model, right? I do, we do, you do. Same thing with parents. They just need that help, that scaffold, and then they will go. But they do care. They just need a little bit of help to get there.
Refugee community, communities. We have communities for each country, and they have appointed leaders from each community. And these leaders are very helpful to families, especially new arrivals. When they come, we give them the numbers for the community that they come from. For example, if they come from Rwanda, there's a Rwandese community here with leaders, and they help them more than anybody else because they speak the same language, they have the same culture, and they are their neighbors. So that has resolved some of the problems.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we have time for one more. Yep. Oh, I didn't see you guys over there. I'm sorry, the lights are so bright. So I heard a, All right, we'll do it.
Is it a question or?
Yes, hello, we have time for three more, it turns out.
Yeah, right on, okay. My name's Tom, and I'm an educator. I teach at West High School. And I started teaching after 12 years of journalism. And I always thought as a journalist you knew what the world was about. But it wasn't until I became a teacher that I learned how to give. And boy, talk about an education. You know, it's never too late to become a teacher. And so let me get your names right. Eddie, yeah. I've done that privilege walk. It's an amazing exercise. If some of you want to stick around, I think Eddie and I can help you go through this exercise. It is amazing. Halima, I've been documenting I'm a photojournalist, been documenting Somali families for 7 years in Utah. And I'm the white guy in the room, and it opens up my eye. And it's an amazing culture, and yet I feel so stupid because I want to judge them, I want to critique them, I want to say, do this, do this, do this. And yet I have to step back as a journalist and say, let me just observe and learn. And that is so important. And I forget your names, Jose.
Jen.
And a lot of Latinos, I congratulate you. I think it's wonderful that your background is so inspiring.
Thank you.
And most of us in this room, I'm going to make a judgment call, but we're NPR addicts, and we all have college degrees. Would you agree?
Yes.
So take a risk. Go to Rose Park, go to Glendale, get out of your car, and walk. And talk to people. Okay? Don't go to the avenues and hide behind your computer screen and just read memes and stuff on Facebook. Get out there, guys. Get out there. Expand your community. Become a worldwide journalist and tell the stories. And I'm going to ask for a little help. As a freelance photographer, journalist, there's nothing to fund us. So if you want to tell me that maybe let's create a fund, let's get some projects going, publish some books, get the stories out there, let's talk. Okay? Because it's hard to do when you're working full time. So thank you.
Thanks. Okay, now who was... Go ahead.
So, first of all, thank you guys so much for being here. I've worked a lot with different people and different communities, different cultures. I worked with, you talked about people being connected and not having a computer at home. I worked with Google Fiber down in Utah County for 2 years, basically trying to bridge that gap and figuring out different classes that we can teach. And one of the things that I learned as I talked with a lot of the teachers who were in that area is, how do we create this balance? Because, like you said, there are people coming to school who don't know the alphabet, who don't know how to add 2 + 2. But then there are others who are. And I have a close family friend and several teachers who've expressed the same basic principle that my son or my daughter gets sent to school, and basically they get dropped to the lowest common denominator, that they feel like they're not really getting educated because everyone else is behind, and so then they're behind as well. And I recognize that we want to go and help everyone, but I also want to figure out, how do we create that balance? Does that make sense? I hope that makes sense, and I want to better understand what you guys are able to do. And I know that you're an amazing teacher, Eddie, and I just don't think that every teacher can be quite that involved. And so what can we expect from regular average Joe to be able to do to help the situation?
Well, in my opinion, it really comes down to the teacher and their expectations. If the teacher puts the time in and teaches the kids to, first of all, get along, no matter where you come from, anything else. Once you establish that and that trust in that little community, almost like a team, then you have the ones who excel, help the ones who need the help. And that's building a bond of friendship. It's a safe environment, just like for me. English and spelling, I'm horrible at it. And it's very embarrassing. I used to hate to read in front of people. Now, I'll read in front of everybody right here. I'm not an expert, but I own my flaws. And if you can teach the kids to love themselves and have self-esteem, that's all you need, is teach it. I have a friend right here, Karen Burns. She does a lot of social justice. Thank you for coming, young lady. And it really is coming about getting along first. If we get all the kids to get along and educators to open up their minds, then a lot of issues will solve themselves, from what I've seen, but it takes a lot of work. It's like a garden. If you don't put that work into it, you're not gonna get the results. Just because you want the results and you say, here, here's fertilizer and this and that, but if you don't give that love to it, it's not gonna succeed. It comes down to open our hearts, our minds, and realize if we don't come together, we're gonna have the same conversation in 5 years, 10 years, just like it hasn't changed too much in my eyes in the last 20 years. Policy have changed, but not how it's implemented, not what the big picture is. How can you have somebody tell you what you should do and they don't walk in your shoes? Like the gentleman we had that was a journalist and now he's a teacher, you get it now. So that's what it comes to, you know? It sounds simple, but it is simple. It doesn't have to be complex. Don't make it harder than it is.
Okay.
Did I answer your question, sir?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, one more, and this is really it.
Hello, thank you for having this. I am so inspired by listening to every one of your stories. I'm actually connected to each and every one of you, and I'm just gonna read from here because I am so nervous, I'm sorry.
You can do it, okay. Girl.
you got this.
Starting from the gentleman with the glasses, I grew up in Miami, Florida. I am a Cuban Colombian. I grew up with different cultures, Pakistani, had a friend that did my henna. I grew up with Black, white, Hispanic. I can sit here and name everyone, right. but and growing up, I'm 34 years old, and I've realized through my years that the way that the students interact, even in college, everyone's in their own secluded area. Like, if me, I am nothing. I don't consider myself Black, white, or anything. So it was for me, I had to go into my white friends to speak to my white friends. I had to go into my Black friends to speak to my Black group, to speak to my Black. Hispanics spoke about Blacks. Blacks spoke about whites. White speaks about Hispanic. And this craziness that I never felt like I was connected to anyone because of this issue. So for you, I have one question. How do we improve the interaction and their communication so they can get along, so we can bring our kids together? Because I see a division, not just in our community, but in schools as well. And it's affected me in my way of learning and my way of interacting. And now I even feel lost here at 34, because I am not Black. I am not white, and I am not Hispanic. I am an American, and it's hard. For the gentleman with the Latino action,
Jose,
the classes, thank you, because we do need this, but we need that for Latinos, we need that for whites, and we need that for Blacks. And I've never been able to empower and advocate for one group, because I don't consider myself only one group. For the advocate classes for the parents, my mother came here illegal, and I'm sorry.
Go ahead, girl, you got it.
My mother was scared to go to school.
My mother never applied for food stamps. My mother was a scared immigrant that was deported in 2006. Never engaged in my schooling because she was scared. How do we take the fear out of these women? How do we empower them to open up and exclude themselves from, I am an immigrant? No, I am a woman. I am a mother. And I have to engage in my community to make me, the kids, accepted, because we're not. We get lost in them. My mom was lost, and I felt lost too. I graduated from school early because I wanted to get out of the school system. I went to day school, I went to night school, and I had a full-time job. So for the immigrants, how do the veteran immigrants, I asked my mother, why didn't you do that? Have we asked the veteran ones, the ones that have been here for 30 years after she got deported? She tells me, because I was scared. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Wonderful. So, with your question, I think it comes from our parents. I think society puts us all against each other, blacks versus Polynesians, Polynesians versus Mexicans, whites versus, I mean, it's just a triangle game of pointing the finger and you did this and you did that. It's not getting to the core of what we need to do. And it trickles down from parents to children. And until we break the chains and get out of our comfort zones, we're gonna have these same children have these feelings. And until, sorry, it's been a long time doing this, and it just comes down to, are you brave enough to say something to somebody when they disrespect you or if they're scared? We all have fears. I have fears. But if you don't chase those fears and challenge them, then you're holding yourself back. So pretty much it just comes down to be brave. Get out of your comfort zone.
So the question you asked is, you know, there should be programs like Latinos in Action for all students. And I get that a lot, and I say, yes, I agree. We actually, 20% of Latinos in Action can be any student that wants to come serve and lead. What we do in this class is leadership, service learning, college and career readiness. But we call it Latinos in Action, and I want to be specific, is because these kids need to be proud of who they are. That's why I always maintain that, because some schools are like, do you want to change the name and call it maybe Leaders in Action? And I'm like, well, you have that. You have student council, right? Like, you already have that. So I want you to understand, I want our kids to understand that their culture is beautiful. Because I think all of you can understand this. If you don't know where you're from or your roots, and you don't know what you're doing here, it's hard to know where you're going. See? They have to understand their roots at enough to be proud of them, right? So in Latinos in Action, we help them understand how beautiful it is to have two languages, to be bicultural, and to then take those talents and help the younger kids, right? So they're role models, immediate role models nestled in our school systems. So that's why we have Latinos, but we welcome all who want, Caucasian kids that have done dual immersion growing up, come join Latinos in Action, and you'll continue that in secondary level. So we welcome, but we always want our youth also to understand who they are so that then in turn they can teach and feel free to be themselves, right? And to be proud of themselves, so.
And on the question of women, and yeah, address that question.
I can hear your pain, and I see that in some of our parents that I get the privilege to work with, but I really think it has a lot to do with what we need to do is to step outside of our schools and go to meet our families where they are and invite them and to help them, to bring them, guide them in whatever way they need, take them by the hand, have somebody else from the community invite them, and to make them feel safe and welcome, and we need to do a better job of making our schools welcoming places for our families where they don't feel so intimidated when they walk in the building and they feel like that the school is for them, because it is. It's for our kids, it's for our families, and we need to make that more clear.
And Halima, on the question of women, you know, are there women mentoring programs where women who've been through this experience and lived through it and lived to tell about it, you know, there to sort of help the others as they newly arrive?
Yeah, so for the refugee communities, we always have women who will be talking to the new arrivals as soon as they come, and they continue to mentor them for about 2 years, show them how to maybe integrate into this culture. It's really difficult. I've been through that, and I can tell you, it's been a long time, but I still feel like I don't belong sometimes, because I learn something new every day. I still feel like this is not home completely. I'm trying. It's got very good things about it, and there are also things that I really miss about home. But the thing is, we just continue trying to learn. So the women are really encouraged to always socialize. So we have events that are like that. And it's the communities doing the events. So like they will do their Independence Day, they'll do their holidays, all that together.
Halima Hussein, Jennifer, Mayor Glenn, Jose Enriquez, and Eddie Brest. I tried to do that without looking at my notes. I think I got it. Did I get it right?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you to you guys. All, you're great. You're rock stars. Thank you so much. Thank you guys for coming. If they want to stay for the privilege walk, if you want to stay for the privilege walk, thanks to the United Way, all the sponsors.
If anybody's interested.
KUER. Thank you very much. Thanks for coming. We really appreciate it.